My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ernie Jackson is a professor and co-director of music production at Queensborough Community College. His latest recording is The Music of Justin Holland. It'll be released by Minnesota Public Radio. That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Black and Fine, produced by With Good Reason. Special thanks to our guests David McCormick and Ernie Jackson. The music of this show was used with their permission. The With Good Reason production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and our executive producer, Sarah McConnell. Our podcast can be found at withgoodreasonradio.org. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's URSULA@pacifica.org. I'm Jamal Milner in Charlottesville. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Join me, Melissa Lesniak, creator and host of That Vegan Show, this Friday, February 28th at 11 a.m., where I interview two of the founders of Ratway Sanctuary, Lionel and Laura. They tell us about the rats they care for, and also we get to hear stories about Alice and Paige, some of the special rats that have been in their care. So tune in February 28th at 11 a.m. to hear That Vegan Show, only here.
Hello, I don't even know your name, but I'm hoping all the same, this is more.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi, and you're listening to Radical Romance, show about non-traditional, non-monogamous relationships. And you are welcome to call in anytime you like. The number to call is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. If you have any questions for me or any questions about your relationship or for my guest today, Wayne Scott. Wayne Scott is a newly published author who wrote a book about his marriage, and I'm not going to say any more about his book, so let me just have Wayne tell you all about his book. Wayne, would you describe what was going on in your marriage that caused you to rewrite the map? Because it's...
Yeah, rewriting the map, that's the right way to describe it. So first of all, thank you for having me having me on your show. I really appreciate it. So it's a memoir, and it's a memoir about marriage. It's called The Maps They Gave Us. One Marriage Reimagined, and it describes a period, kind of a crisis period in my own marriage about 14 years in, when my spouse and I decided to transition from more conventional monogamous arrangement to a non-monogamous arrangement.
14 years ago. 14 years ago, I'm guessing you still had kids at home.
Yeah, actually, no, it was 14 years after we got married that we made the transition. So we had three school-age children. So lots of, you know, domestic responsibilities, lots of kind of, you know, three children need two parents. It's a lot of work. But we were also in what psychologists refer to as a mixed orientation marriage, which means one person is straight and one person is not. And so in my case, I identify as queer or bisexual. And at the 14-year mark of being married, it became difficult to sort of disown or lop off that part of myself. And so that's what led us to look at other alternatives. We actually, for most of the memoir, the couple that's being described, they think they're getting divorced. One of the things I was interested in showing in the story was just how messy and how long it can take for a couple to sort of figure out, unlearn their socialization and figure out the, as you said, the rewriting of the map. Sometimes rewriting a map where there isn't actually a map, they're actually, you know, they're the cartographers. They're the ones that are surveying the land and figuring out how to draw it.
Your book is about your marriage, though. You said a memoir.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it written in first person, or it's just written about your marriage?
It's written in first person. You know, in addition to being a writer, I'm a psychotherapist, but the writer part of me has always been in critique groups with other writers. And it's a really common practice in critique groups that if you're writing memoir, you refer to the characters, even yourself, in the third person. You don't, because if you start talking too much about I, people start supporting you like it's a group therapy situation, and you don't want that. You want them to focus on the story and whether the story works. So sometimes I slip and I'll say, the couple think that they're getting divorced. Well, it's me. I thought I was getting divorced like the whole time. And it's also, I think, about the one of the things, you know, so this memoir began as separate essays I wrote for different journals. About some of the quirky, weird things that happened to us as we were going along this path toward non-monogamy. Some of it funny, but some of it also painful. And when at a certain point I lined up all the essays chronologically, and I realized, you know what, if I filled in a few gaps here and there, I could have a book. And one of the things that I didn't realize when I was writing this kind of quirky memoir about marriage is describing a couple going through this crucible experience of thinking they're going to get divorced, is that one of the surprising through lines was that there was a lot of love. There was actually a lot of devotion. And that, in fact, in writing a story about a couple who think they're getting divorced, I had actually written an atypical love story, you know, a love story that comes out of a crucible.
Sure. I was talking to you earlier about my experience, and my ex and I went through a mediated divorce, mm-hmm. and how I found myself growing closer to my ex because we were discussing everything in more depth than we did at home, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm curious if you think your wife would characterize everything as the way you did or differently from you?
Yeah. I'm sure she would tell a different story because mm-hmm. we're different people. Different people. And actually, when I'm doing interviews, I've got about three bullet points about her perspective mm-hmm. that she has pre-approved for me to share. And then usually if it's not in the book, I don't usually try to speculate about what she thinks. Sure. It's interesting. You mentioned when we first started seeing a professional, we were seeing a divorce mediator because we thought we were getting divorced. It's really common as part of the mediation process. One of the first things they ask a couple to do is they say, come up with a common story. You have to come up with a story that shares elements of both of your realities about where you came from in this relationship and how do you got to this point of transition. And that'll help with telling your children, telling your friends, telling your family. You have to have a common story. And it was a really interesting challenge for me because I'm a writer, so I think about how stories work, mm-hmm. right? And so that actually became, that's kind of in the prologue of the memoir, that's how it opens up of the challenge of coming up with a common story. We had to figure out how we got to this point in a way where we had compassion for each other.
I have to ask you, I'm changing the topic slightly, as a gay man, I lost my train of thought. Before you met your wife, were you bisexual?
Yeah, you know, it was a tricky time. I came of age in the late 80s and early 90s. which was a very different time from now. The kind of inclusive term queer that we have now, that just kind of includes everybody in the LGBTQ umbrella, yes. Right? It did not exist then, other than as a pejorative. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the sexual identity politics were very, very polarized. It was kind of like gay people against the world because of the, I mean, this was like the darkest period of the AIDS pandemic. There was no, you know, there was no cure. It was a death sentence. It was a very frightening time. And, you know, at a time too, when there was just massive neglect and stigmatization of the gay and bisexual male community. And so to say one was bisexual during that era was a very tricky thing. There was a lot of stigma attached to it. There had always been skepticism about bisexuality at that time. People thought it was just a thing people said on their way to becoming fully gay, which is not really true, or to most bisexual people's experience. But I think more negatively, bisexual men were seen as the carriers of the virus from the gay community to the straight community. Mm. So looking back, you know, I would say from a behavioral perspective, I would describe myself as bisexual, but during the time period, I mostly describe myself as gay because that was the accepted word that I had access to. Even though, yeah, the language was inadequate, and I think that's one of the through lines in the memoirs is the inadequacy of language we have to talk about intimate relationships, to give room for intimate relationships to grow and to adapt and to evolve over time. We have a very static binary language.
Yes. At what point did you come out, if that's the right term, to your wife, prior to marriage or after marriage?
Definitely prior. When I asked her out on a first date, we ran in the same group of friends, and when I asked her out on the first date, she went to one of our common friends and says, "You know, why is this gay guy asking me out on a date? What the hell is this? What is going on here?" And the friend said, "You know, that's the word he uses, but he actually sees women as well. You know, it just isn't as well known." So, yeah, and I think the other thing that was going on during this time period, late 80s, 90s, this is third wave feminism. So many women, heterosexual women, were thinking about the kinds of heterosexual men they wanted to be with, and maybe wanting men that were a little bit, you know, didn't fit the stereotypical way that men behaved. You know, they were interested in men who were sort of gender atypical or questioning some of the ways we're socialized.
I'm curious, what are the ground rules that the two of you eventually came up with regarding outside encounters from the marriage?
Yeah, well, that's for any couple that makes this kind of a transition, and it isn't easy, and I don't prescribe it for anyone, but for some people, you know, it's a necessity, and it helps them to evolve their relationship. You know, when you're monogamous, you get the ground rules. They're in your vows. And there's a lot of cultural stuff that's holding you together and kind of lets you know what the guardrails are, right? When you transition to non-monogamous, you have to come up with the ground rules yourself. And in my experience, every non-monogamous couple is different. You know, you have people where they have a kind of a don't ask, don't tell arrangement. And that's what works for them. For us, we just had pretty clear boundaries. I mean, this was a period of time where we were raising kids. It was a lot of work raising kids. So there wasn't a lot of discretionary time to do other things. So we had pretty clear agreements that, you know, we kept what happened in our family home was really about raising our kids and being a family. We didn't bring outside partners there unless by intent and conscious decision that we were going to do that. We always made an effort if one person was seeing someone seriously, if she had a boyfriend she was seeing seriously, I would meet him eventually and get to know him, and vice versa. That was important so that it didn't feel so threatening, you know, like the stranger just drives up mm-hmm. in a car and she gets in and goes away. That would be, that would feel very threatening. So, mm-hmm. you know, those were some of the rules. You have to have agreements about how much you want to know about what the other person is doing.
That's a great thing to cover, which is, how much do you disclose to your wife? If you have an outside encounter,
Yeah. I think in the memoir, what the couple work out is it's relatively minimal. They make sure that they meet each other's partners, but they also make sure that they put a lot of time and effort into kind of honoring and strengthening their relationship, that's got to stay strong in order to have this kind of a, you know, creative marital arrangement work. Mm-hmm.
So all this time later, have you settled into a comfort level as a couple for what it all means to the marriage?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say yes. The period of time depicted in the memoir is a very stormy period. It does end in a place where people are more settled and committed to the path and that kind of thing. And of course, now this is, we've been in a non-monogamous arrangement now for about 15 years. So that's a pretty long time. We've been together over 30 years. So, you know, we're pretty settled with each other. We know each other really well. We enjoy spending time with each other. Yeah.
Are your close couple friends aware of the kind of marriage you have now?
I think it would be hard for them not to be, just because I've written so much about this for journals and things like that. And there was, like, in 2020, I had an essay in the New York Times Modern Love column. And so that got a lot of attention and traction. So once it's, you know, once it's in the New York Times, it's kind of hard to keep it off people's radar. So,
in my mind, there are two different kinds of open marriages. They're the kinds where you are, or either member of the couple is free to have outside sex, or outside romance. How many times over the years have either one of you developed feelings for someone you're getting to know on an intimate basis?
Yeah, I can really only speak to the period that's described in the memoir, because in the memoir, both the husband and the wife have an outside relationship, and it's an ongoing relationship with the same person. And so excuse me, it's not just physical. Obviously, you develop friendliness, you develop affection and warmth for that person. Mm-hmm. We were always really careful to make sure that we honored and protected our bond, and that none of these outside relationships would be a threat to that. Didn't mean we weren't sometimes insecure or jealous. We were. And every non-monogamous couple has to navigate that, you know, and some of that you navigate on your own. You have to just figure it out. Where does my insecurity and jealousy come from? And some of it you can actually navigate together. Like maybe I have to ask her to do things a little bit differently.
Are there any absolute deal breakers that either one of you could not tolerate happening with your partner?
I hope not. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, human beings can do all kinds of horrendous things, but we're both like very kind people, and we're both social workers. So we both have a basic sort of strong foundation of kindness and love and warmth. So it's hard for me to imagine either of us would do anything so egregious that, you know, we'd be calling it quits. I think, at least from my perspective, having gone through what we've gone through, you know, I feel like we've kind of achieved something, you know, kind of achieved something kind of special and interesting and unique, you know. And one of the motivations I had to write the memoir was to add to that conversation that I think is going on now in our culture, of people talking about all the ways in which in long-term intimate relationships they have to evolve and adapt and sometimes break up a little bit so that they can make more room for people to grow. Because that's, we grow as we're getting older, as we're aging, and we change. And so our marriage, are the containers for our intimate relationships, they have to morph too. I tell a lot of my clients, because I see a lot of clients who are transitioning from monogamous to non-monogamous. And one of the things that's always struck me is that every marriage is multiple marriages kind of strung together over time, you know, and at every point the couple has to collaboratively update and revise what's this iteration of our marriage going to look like. You know, we have kids, we don't have kids, we're retiring, you know, all the different changes that happen.
A minute ago you mentioned the word kindness, and actually that was what I planned on talking about after you and I are done with this discussion. Mm-hmm. What would you say are the important emotional stances one should take to have a happy, healthy, open marriage, so to speak?
Yeah. Definitely kindness, right? To enter into any difficult or sensitive conversation with positive regard for the other person, with kindness, with warmth, to always default to that, you know, whenever possible. I think in order to do this, one needs to expand one's capacity for empathy, for right. understanding where the other person is coming from, which may be different from where you're coming from.
I love your attitude. It's great, in my opinion, because
I talk a good talk.
Yes, yes, you do. But what I was going to talk about later is the Buddhist take on emotions. And it's down to that idea of responding rather than reacting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what you say, it's how you say it.
Mm-hmm.
So...
yeah, I mean, so sort of an analogous thing in my practice as a psychotherapist working with couples is rethinking how we talk about these static terms like insecurity and jealousy. Mm-hmm. We talk about them as if they're a type of pathology that resides in you. It's a sickness in you if you're jealous or you're insecure, that kind of thing. And I don't think that's a very useful, it's a very blaming kind of way of talking about it. People feel bad. It just adds additional shame to the situation. Yeah. The way I talk about it with couples is that you introduce an additional layer of threat when you have a non-monogamous arrangement. And it's on both people in the relationship to figure out how do we protect ourselves from the threat or neutralize the threat. And so it's not really a pathology in you or in me. It's really like I have to understand where does this threat, this sense of threat come from?
Yes, yes. What I wanted to go to with this line of thought is one of the things I'm going to talk about again, the Buddhist approach to our emotions. They have something called the divine emotions, one of them being empathic joy, meaning one's ability to be happy for the other person's happiness. Are there times where either one of you has found that particularly difficult? If one of you is having a particularly good time with whoever you're getting to know outside of the marriage on an intimate level, and do you have to, again, think before you speak about what you're going to share and how you're going to share it? So,
yeah.
Your happiness is not threatening to your partner.
Right.
That's something to manage, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's this in a lot of the pop psychology literature about non-monogamy, like books like The Ethical Slut or Polysecure, they talk about this concept of compersion, you know, which is when you take joy in the discoveries that your partner is making in the romantic world and stuff like that. I mean, I think it's a theoretical term. Like, sometimes you feel it, but sometimes you don't. Sometimes, you know, what they're doing can feel very threatening. And there's a chapter in the memoir, which is this, it's called the long night of the date, you know, when she goes out with this really nice guy who I grew to like myself. But when she first started seeing him, when she would leave, I would feel profoundly left. And all kinds of insecurities and jealousies and all kinds of stuff would come up for me. Mm-hmm. Now, in a monogamous relationship, marriage, the way that I would take care of those jealousies and insecurities is that I would try to change something in her. I would rein her in. I would say, you can't go out with people I'm jealous of. You know, that's bad for our marriage. But in a non-monogamous arrangement, you actually have to kind of look inside yourself. Where did these feelings come from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had to look at all of my experiences, you know, growing up as kind of this kind of queer, gender atypical, misfit kid. You know, you absorb a lot of shame from the world that there's something wrong with you. And all of that came back for me full force when she was, you know, kind of dating these regular straight guys. I felt very threatened, and again, because of what we had agreed to do, you can't follow your most primitive feelings. You gotta sure. always try to be your best self, and you know.
Sure. I want to give our listeners an opportunity to call in if they have any questions for you, or me about your book or relationships in general. Listeners, you've got two licensed therapists here, myself and my guest, and the number to call is 503-231-8187 if you have any calls for either of us. Again, 503-231-8187. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Please feel free to call in. So back to your thoughts, Wayne.
Yeah. I can't remember what my thoughts were, but you know, actually, since you're doing giving some of the signature information, I would mention if people are interested in getting their hands on the memoir, in addition to being in bookstores, our independent bookstores that we're so proud of in Portland, they can also order them through my website, which is Wayne Scott Writes, or they can go directly to the publisher. It's a small independent.
Say it
publisher.
Again, Wayne Scott
Writes.
Writes. W-R-I-T-E, like write the word.
Yeah, like yeah, and okay. The active form of the verb, yeah, .com. Or they can go to Black Lawrence Press, which is the small independent press that is publishing it. And they've been wonderful to me. They have been great. So I always want people to track back to their website and buy
Excellent.
From them.
What does your wife think of the book?
I think that's a good question, too. I mean, I think she... You know, my approved talking points, you know, when I asked her, you know, what am I going to say when people ask me this question, is that, you know, I think it was a difficult decision to decide to share our story. You know, when I asked her if I could pull together all these essays and make a book, I think she gave a deep sigh. But I think she's also, you know, she's used to living with a guy who writes memoir. It's not the first time she's been, you know, a character in one of my stories and one of my essays. And I think she also thought that it was a story worth sharing. You know, part of our experience as a couple, as a distraught couple, thinking we had to get divorced because conventional heteronormative marriage didn't fit us. It was very important to us that at a certain point in the journey, the professional who was working with us, this mediator / couples counselor, she said to us, well, have the two of you ever considered having a non-monogamous marriage? Because you seem very devoted to each other. You seem like you really love each other. What about that option? And I still remember that day. We were stunned that she could make such a recommendation or such a suggestion, right? Because I thought, as a therapist myself, I thought that was a naughty word. I thought you weren't ever supposed to suggest that to a couple. Couples therapists up to that point had mostly been trained in a very monogamy only paradigm, right? And if you ever talked about open marriages or non-monogamy, it was as if they were an aberration or a pathology, right?
Yeah.
But you know, in 2007 in Portland, Oregon, that was not the case. And in fact, she said, this couples counselor who was extraordinary said, you know what, you get to tell the story of your marriage. You get to make it whatever you want it to be. Other people don't determine your story. You mm-hmm. determine your story. And if you want to make it work, you can make it work.
What has changed since 2007?
Well, we got off the path towards divorce. So we decided.
But actually, I was speaking more big picture of culturally. The people of Portland has the whole concept of a negotiated open marriage. Has it changed? Has it become more accepted? Are people less surprised when the two of you come out about the kind of marriage you've created, co-created as a team?
Yeah, I mean, I probably have a skewed perception on this because in my therapy practice, the people who gravitate towards me because of things I've written, the people who gravitate towards, the clients who gravitate towards me are all interested in exploring non-monogamy. And so it sometimes looks to me as if everybody in Portland is non-monogamous, but that can't possibly be true. I have generally found that there is kind of an openness and that people are just not particularly bothered by it. I think there's definitely still for couples who are in very conventional heteronormative arrangements, it can seem a little threatening, and sometimes we will get a reactive or judgmental response. But part of that is because in their path, this is my speculation, but on their path, they were never allowed to have a conversation about the kind of container mm-hmm. they had. Mm-hmm. Their permission wasn't given. That's actually similar to my story when we came together and decided we were going to actually get married, have a wedding ceremony. We were told that it had to be shaped and it had to look a certain way, including the vows. The vows were very kind of prescriptive. Had to have God in the vows. You had to have fidelity in the vows. This was very strongly told to us by the ministers that we were working with. So there wasn't a conversation. You just had to do, you kind of felt like you had to do what you were told to do.
What would you say are maybe the top three or top five characteristics one needs to bring to a remapped marriage, so to speak?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, what I said earlier, I think what you said earlier, which is just a general kind of undercurrent of kindness and warmth and love for each other, that has to be there. I think a sort of expanded sense of empathy that, you know, you understand your own reality of the relationship, but you are open that there is another person's reality that may be different, that you have to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a commitment and willingness to balance how do we stay connected and how do we nurture our togetherness with how do we create room for individual growth and healing, adaptation, you know, as we change over the course of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's three. Is that will that work? So that's what I got.
What are each of your abilities for empathic joy, the ability to be happy for the other person's happiness?
Well, I definitely think, you know, during the period of the memoir, that was something we were working on, you know, because, you know, I think, again, for most of the period of the memoir, the couple thinks they're getting divorced. So that, you know, when you think you're getting divorced, you're going through one of the worst periods of your life,
mm-hmm.
very stressed out, feeling very embattled. So it's hard when you're feeling embattled by the other person to, you know, to have an excess of positive feeling.
Well, let me give you the opportunity to tell the listeners about the process of making that transition, either for the two of you or for people who come to see you in your practice.
Yeah. Well, I'll say for the two of us, again, we we started to see a divorce mediator who also happened to do couples work. Mm-hmm. And she was very generous in terms of not pushing us to define what we were doing, whether we were doing divorce mediation or couples counseling. She just kind of let it be an open question for a really significant period of time. And that was actually really helpful. It was helpful for us to stay in that kind of liminal, undetermined period where we could just kind of sort out what was going on. We weren't rushed down one path or the other, which is interesting because I don't know what how much it costs now, but in 2007, the period of the memoir, if you were getting divorce mediation, it was $220 an hour. If you were getting couples counseling, it was $150 an hour. So it's cheaper to stay together, definitely. But for some reason, and it's one of the mysteries in the memoir, this particular healer, Lene is what she's called in the memoir, she did not press us to say what we were doing. Where were we divorcing or were we doing counseling? And that actually ended up being a gift. You know, because I think when you're in the midst of a crisis, you know, it's easy to just do the most dramatic thing, you know, to say, well, it's obviously if our marriage is not working, then we should just get divorced. We should just throw in the towel, not to have a lot of patience that maybe we just need to have this very long period of reckoning and discerning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the other thing is that Lene, the therapist that we ended up working with, she created a really strong container for us to come together and have difficult, sensitive conversations, you know, as we were working on figuring out our shared narrative, our common story. She held the space for us to do that. Sometimes she was patient when neither one of us was not. You know, she would remind us to have grace, to have patience. And that was all really, it was very, very helpful for us to have worked with a very progressive couples counselor, you know, who was open to lots of possibilities. And again, the fact that she made the suggestion to us and that she affirmed that they can work and that she knew other couples who made open arrangements work, that had an incredible impact on both of us.
Sure. I'm going to begin to wrap up pretty soon. If you have any calls for Wayne or myself before Wayne leaves today, please give us a buzz at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. You've been listening to Radical Romance, the show for those in non-traditional relationships. You may be a couple, a thruple, a quad, a quint. Please call in whatever you are. We're happy to entertain your questions. And then we're going to bring this interview to an end pretty soon. So, Wayne, what would you like your listeners to know about your memoir?
Primarily, I'll let folks know that if they want to get their hands on it, they can go to my website, which is WayneScottWrites.com, or they can go to Black Lawrence Press. Those are the two best places to get it if you're ordering online. Or
Black Lawrence or Lawrence?
Lawrence, like the name Lawrence.
LAW RENCE,
yeah. Black Lawrence Press. Or they can go to local bookstores. I'll be doing a reading at Broadway Books on March 13th.
And then awesome.
And I'll be doing another reading April at Annie Bloom's, and I'll be in conversation with other writers. So again, it'll be kind of like you and I talking now. It's more a conversation. That I think that's the most helpful thing that we can do is to continue to have open, visible conversations that mm-hmm. a marriage can take a lot of different shapes, and they're all valid. And we're not prescribing one over the other. We're just saying that there are lots of different ways that mm-hmm. marriages can morph over time.
I'm curious, this is kind of a prurient question, but have the two of you ever been in a group setting, social group setting, where you both had your eye on the same man? since the kind of activities you'd be looking for outside of your marriage would be with a man, both of you. Have you ever again thought, I want him? No, I want him.
That has never happened to us, but man, that would be an interesting essay, wouldn't it? That would, you know, like yeah. I almost want it to happen so I could write that essay and,
yeah.
you know, because I'm intrigued by the weird predicaments that human beings find themselves yes. in and how they navigate.
Oh, I have to ask you this because I don't think you've gone through this, but when my husband and I were married and we decided to open things up, we each eventually found a significant partner, and we brought those partners into our home with our children. Our children knew we were emotionally attached to these partners, and in fact, we would have like a group Sunday dinner every Sunday evening where the four adults would take turns cooking, and we'd all sit down with the kids and have dinner. Did you and your wife come out to your kids, so to speak, about your remapped marriage?
Yeah, our children were school aged at the time, and they knew what was going on and what we were doing, and you know, we just kind of tried to tailor it in a way that was developmentally appropriate to where they're at. And of course, now they're young adults, and yeah, I found it. People always ask me, how are the kids doing, or how are the kids dealing with this? And the interesting thing is, they are very unaffected by it. Most kids don't care right. about their parents' marriage, or unless they're right. arguing and or there's domestic violence. But sure. if things are going, if they're getting to their soccer games and they're getting to school and they're right. seeing their friends, and you've got the cupboards stocked with the foods they like, most kids are pretty happy.
You're right. Although I have to share briefly, during this period where we were involving the boys, we had two sons. We still have two sons. They're both still alive. So anyway, my younger son, when I was driving, the older one, I was driving him to school one day, and he turned to me and said, Papa, most people who are married don't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, right? Most people don't. I said, no, most people don't. But you know, our marriage and our family has never been like the typical family, mm-hmm. which involves a mother and a father, and the two of you have two fathers. We've always been different. So now the fact that each of the fathers have a boyfriend makes us to simply stay a different family and different couple. So that's the answer to my question. Yes, most people don't, but we do. We've always been different. We're staying different.
Well, so. The one modification I would make to that from my experience is that not that most people don't, but that most people don't talk about it. Because I actually think it's more common than is thought, but I think that there's so much stigma attached to it that many people don't talk openly about it. You know, one of the biggest challenges for any couple when they're going down this route is how open are we going to be mm-hmm. with our neighbors, with our family, you know, mm-hmm. with the people, the parents of our children's friends and things like that. And it's a hard decision to make because, again, there's stigma out there and there's bias. And
excellent point.
Yeah.
What would you say is the biggest change at this point in your marriage? I mean, at this point, you're married way, way longer than the average American couple.
You know, the biggest change we have right now has nothing to do with non-monogamy. It's really more that we're empty nesters, and our children have all, you know, kind of mm-hmm. sprung the nest and, you know, are kind of living these independent lives. And so, you know, we're figuring out what to do with a big empty house.
So, some would say all the more room in your lives to have additional partners.
So, you know, I think it's such a big transition. I think you know this as well, for any parent, when you're no longer parenting 24/7, there's a big, it creates a big space of time, and you know, definitely you can fill that with other people, but there's also a little bit of grief and loss that goes along with that path, not in a bad way,
mm-hmm.
you know, but you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
I'm glad you said not in a bad way, because I just want those who are listening to understand that what you're talking about is just regular human feelings, feeling that anyone would have.
Yeah.
So let me give you one last opportunity to push your book, tell people the name of your book, where they can find it, and again about the upcoming, what did they call them, book readings?
Yeah, book readings. Yeah, so you can get the book at my website, Wayne Scott Writes. You can also get it at the website of the publisher, which is Black Lawrence Press. And I'll be reading at Broadway Books on March 13th. And then I'll be reading at Annie Bloom's on April something. I don't know. But if you go to Annie Bloom's website, I know it's on their website.
And your website, I'm guessing?
It's on my website as well.
And your website is?
WayneScottWrites.com.
WayneScottWrites.com.
Yeah.
I believe we're going to wrap up the interview at this point, and I'll let you get on with your life. I want to thank you for being so candid with me and our listeners.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show, and thank you for asking so many intelligent questions. I appreciated it.
Absolutely. My pleasure. We'll do it again sometime. So keep me posted, Wayne.
Yeah, thank you.
It was a pleasure meeting you, and I think we'll take a little break right now for some music.
Say, love me, leave me, let me be lonely. You won't believe me, but I love you only. I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody else. You might find the night time the right time for kissing. Night time is my time for just reminiscing. Regretting instead of forgetting with somebody else. There'll be no one unless that someone is you. I intend to be independently blue. Say, hey, hey, I want your love, don't want to borrow. Have it today to give back tomorrow. Your love is my love, there's no love for nobody else.
Hi, everybody. This is Tony Zimbardi, Dr. Tony Zimbardi, host of Radical Romance, the show for those who are in or contemplating non-traditional relationships, meaning you might be a single or a couple who are curious about becoming a throuple or quad or something else. The whole range from outside sex to additional romantic partners in your relationship. If you have any questions about them, we're running low on time today, but the phone number to call in is 503-231-8187. Again, 503-231-8187. You're listening to Radical Romance. This is KBOO-FM, and I am your host, Dr. Tony Zimbardi. I was interviewing my guest Wayne Scott earlier, before our little musical interlude, we were talking about how he remapped his marriage with his wife with the help of a mediator. We were talking about a little bit about tips, and so I'm going to talk now a little bit about tips of approaching your partner or partners about how to resolve conflict in your relationship. And my theme for that today is taking a Buddhist approach. And I got the information I'm going to talk about right now from, I'm on the wrong page. I need to flip my book, see where I put the information on Buddhism. And so here we go. The Buddhists believe from the Confucius Book of Rites that as human beings in general, we have 7 basic emotions and 6 desires, which are joy, anger, sorrow, pleasure, love, hate, and desire, and that they have elevated 4 emotions in particular, all of which are going to help improve your relationship. Those 4 divine emotions, my favorite, which is empathic joy, the ability to be happy for someone else's happiness, can be challenging in a relationship that includes individuals more than your primary partner. Is empathic joy, again, being happiness, one of them. Goodwill towards your partner, compassion, and equanimity, which is basic fairness and doing your absolute best to keep things equal, equanimity. They believe that's one of our 4 divine emotions, which I do too. And basic rule of thumb, it's not what you say, but how you say it. Think before you speak. I had used the term earlier in this program of SOTA, the acronym, stop, observe, think before you speak, stop, observe, think, act. Acting is what you're going to say and how you're going to say it. Stop, observe, think, and act. And try to act with goodwill, compassion, happiness for your partner, and with an equanimous approach, an equal approach, a basic fairness to what you're going to say, how you're going to say it, how to express your thoughts. If you're listening and you'd like to call in, if you have any questions, call 503-231-8187. You're listening to Radical Romance with Dr. Tony Zimbardi, KBOO-FM 90.7 on your dial. So please feel free to give me a call anytime you like. We are the 2nd and 4th Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. of the month. Always, every month, 2nd and 4th Wednesday, 10 a.m. Just to push Wayne Scott one last time and his new book, which is on remapping your marriage or your relationship. I want to thank Wayne again for being my guest today and giving me a great interview. Refresh on those Buddhist basic human emotions, joy, anger, sorrow, pleasure, love, hate, and the sexy one, desire. Those divine emotions, goodwill, compassion, empathic joy, and equanimity. So I want you to keep these things in mind when you... I want you to keep these things in mind when you're dealing with your partner. I'm told I have a caller. Go ahead, caller. This is Dr. Tony.
Hi. Yeah, this is Adam. I was calling... I recently started seeing somebody who's in an open marriage, and I wondered if you had any advice for kind of how to, as somebody outside of the relationship, how to have a successful relationship with somebody who is in an open marriage.
Don't hold back. Those are my three words for you. Any questions, just ask.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for calling in. We have just about 5 minutes left of the show today. Any other callers? 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. You're listening to KBOO FM 90.7. And I want to thank our contributors, those who keep this radio station alive. Without your contributions, we wouldn't have the programs we do. So please let everyone here know how you're doing and show it with your financial support. Keep us going. This show is on the second and fourth Wednesday morning of every month. I want to thank you all for listening today. This has been Radical Romance. This is Dr. Tony Zimbardi. I appreciate the call I received today. I appreciated our guest, Wayne Scott, so much for his interview today. And I'll be here to talk with you all again in about 2 weeks, second and fourth Wednesday. I'll be back.
Hello, I don't even know your name, but I'm hoping all the same. This is more than just a simple hello.
Hello, do I smile and look away? No, I think I smile and stay to see where this might go.
We're alone, somewhere quiet on our own, so that we can fall the rest of the way.
I know that before the night is through, I'll be talking love to you, meaning every word I
long before I knew what I'm
of kisses don't seem as sweet to me. This year's crop just misses what kisses used to be. This year's new romance doesn't seem to have a chance, even helped by Mr. Moon above. Oh, this year's crop of kisses is not for me, 'cause I'm still wearing last year's love.
The best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness.